Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today I'm speaking with architects Harper Halperin and Aaron Lesh of AHA Studio in Los Angeles. Their newly unveiled Case Study 2.0 initiative reimagines the spirit of the original Case Study House program from the 1940s, following World War II, for our world confronting climate change and wildfire risk. Their 3,900 square foot residential prototype demonstrates that thoughtful design, affordability, and resilience can work together without compromise. Through their work, Harper and Aaron challenge us to think differently about the future of housing in fire-prone regions and how architects can lead with purpose and clarity. Harper Halperin and Aaron Lesh, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
Good to have you both. This is going to be a very interesting conversation. I am very interested in this case study house that you're putting together. And I want to also understand the background of the original case study, and we don't have to dive too deep into that, but just so we can have some context for that. But before we do that, I want to learn more about each of you. I'd like you to share your origin stories. So Harper, you go first. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
I think it was less of a singular pivotal moment and more of kind of a long burn. I would say that, you know, at a very young age, I was very interested about, you know, how things came together and building. I'm a bit of a serial organizer. My brain works in terms of finding the problem and immediately seeking a solution. And I think all of those really dovetail quite nicely into the profession and what it, you know, offers people whose brains work this way, I would say. Yeah. But I think that some of the smaller things that happened when I was young, my mom got into interior design at a very young age, and I really got the chance to kind of see things as I would go on installs with her, and that we would watch furniture being installed, and I would run around with, you know, paints and just kind of be crazy in these new homes. And I think that that really was a very interesting thing to be involved in as, I think, a five-year-old maybe. And then, you know, also just really being into art and architecture and the history of it throughout school and my education.
Were you introduced to the profession of architecture through your mom? Because interiors, you grew up in interiors, obviously you probably ran into some architects along the way, but was there a specific moment where you're like, architecture is where I want to go?
I don't think it really struck me until much later, it maybe even in high school. And, you know, you're taking aptitude tests, I think. And right. Yeah. All the aptitude tests kept saying, oh, you're an architect. You're an architect. It kept like slapping me in the face in a way. And that just made sense. I think from an early age, people were like, oh, you would be a great architect. And the one thing that was really important in this development was my dad always said, you know, be a professional, do something in a professional capacity. He was a lawyer, and I have a sister and myself, and he really wanted both his girls to have strong professions to back them up in their, you know, livelihoods and for other reasons. And so I think that that was just something that really stuck. Well, if I'm going to be a professional, this seems like a really good profession to be in. I think I knew nothing really of what architecture was or what it was going to be in reality, but then going into school to study it as an undergrad, you quickly learn what it means to be an architect. And it's almost this secret society that you get to be a part of. And I fell in love with it quite immediately.
Where did you go to school?
USC.
And then when you graduated, what did you do before you started AHA?
So Aaron and I actually went to USC together, and we met first day of school there. We went through all of our architectural education, all 5 years, one of which included studying abroad in Italy, in Como. And that was an amazing experience, but we were both born and bred in Southern California. And so we decided we wanted to spend some time outside of the area, especially after studying abroad and being exposed to just new locations. And with that, we decided that we were going to move to New York for a stint. We said 2 to 3 years. We ended up being there for 5 years because, you know, you fall in love with the city and you forget. Time goes quite quickly. And we got an amazing experience working for some really great studios there. And I think that dovetailed back into my background in interior design and really getting involved in, you know, interior spaces in New York and really understanding what it took to have amazing architecture and amazing interior design really meet and be copacetic and really resonate with one another.
And then what brought you back to LA?
Reality a little bit. We had gotten married while we were in New York, and we decided that, you know, we always knew we wanted a family, and having children in the city wasn't the best option for us.
Yeah.
You're really paving the way to a little bit more difficulty, especially not having family local. So we decided, okay, we're going to go back to LA. And when we moved back, we decided we were going to get licensed so that we could practice architecture with a capital A in California, and did that quickly, got some experience working for some really great studios here locally, learning the ins and outs of California residential architecture, commercial spaces, tenant improvement, a bunch of different disciplines within Los Angeles. And then I had always wanted to start a studio. So I think it came earlier than I thought it would. It wasn't something I fully baked into my plan. It was something that started a little bit more naturally. And looking back, I'm so thankful that that happened, because I don't know that I ever would have had the chutzpah to jump in to say, I am starting my own studio. But when you do it a little more gradually, I think that it takes your training wheels off at a better pace.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Excellent story. And Aaron, share your story. Where was the inspiration early on to follow architecture?
I can't remember a time before I wanted to be an architect. I don't know why. There was not a person in my life I knew who was an architect. I didn't quite know, like Harper said, exactly what architecture was until, well, frankly, I'm still kind of figuring it out. So maybe by the end of the week. But I always had an interest in art and design in some way. I think I just had an eye for how things were made and an attention to detail. I was always noticing small things, you know, furniture or details or connections, you know, whether it be just objects or, you know, houses and things like that. And I was also very math oriented in school. So I was just kind of naturally had a affinity toward math. And naturally, architecture is the mix of a lot of different interests. There's a little bit of art, a little bit of engineering, a little bit of math, a little bit of people skills, a lot of people skills. So it's a really a good nexus of a lot of those interests. I don't have I should say I'm very interested in a lot of different things, and architecture allows you to maintain those interests, you know, within the broader field. You can go so many different directions with it, not just in style of architecture or in discipline, but you can get into lighting design, you can get into decorative arts, you can get into landscape. There's so many different pieces of that puzzle, which are really interesting. And it was just a great way to, you know, encapsulate those. I think that, you know, I knew what an engineer was from my grandfather who had an interest in it, but an architect, I think I only knew because of some Frank Lloyd Wright books someone had given me as a kid, you know, which interested me, but I still didn't quite understand them past you get a large drafting board, you know, you take out your pencils and you hand it to someone and you stand on the hill in your suit and your cape and you watch it get made. So, you know, it, like I said, it's taken my entire career up until this moment to, you know, continue to learn what an architect really does and what our role is, but it's a really great way to pursue a lot of different interests at once.
Yeah. When did the studio start? When did you open?
Harper started it under a different name in 2015, 2016. It was just her and some assistants along the way with some interns and some friends that were helping. And then it really became a full-fledged, you know, off and running studio in, I guess, late 2016, 2017, when I joined in full-time.
So 2016, and is that when AHA was started?
Technically, AHA wasn't born until 2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
I market with our children. So I started HH Design when, after the birth of our first child, Eliana, and then we started AHA Studio after I was pregnant with our second son, Jude. So yeah, it's marked by our children.
Got it. So 6 to 8 or 9 years, somewhere mm-hmm. around there, depending yep. on where you market.
Yep. Exactly.
Okay. So tell me, when your team reached out to me to talk on the podcast, they introduced me to the case study 2.0 project that you're doing, which was very interesting to me. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about that. I wasn't aware of the original case study house program. I'm sure I was taught about it in architecture school, but I probably was sleeping that day. And so before we jump into your case study house, can you just give us just an overview background of what the original case study program was about?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're raised and educated in an environment where the case study program looms quite large in Southern California. So it was always a part of our lexicon. And it was a program started by the now defunct Arts and Architecture magazine post-World War II. They sponsored this initiative and hired or commissioned 8 to 10 architects to develop some prototypes with themselves, you know, the magazine itself as the client, to plan for the incoming kind of housing boom that was going to happen post-World War. And, you know, arts and architecture was kind of very modern focused and interested in what capital M modernism was going to look like moving forward, and tasked the architects with creating these prototypes that could be cheaply built, which in hindsight is quite funny, but cheaply built, you know, potentially on a mass scale to help with this housing initiative, right? But with an eye toward what does it mean to be a modern house in, you know, the new coming decade of the 50s and the mid-century. And what does it look like, you know, specifically in Los Angeles with these ideals, you know, not just make it steel and glass, but what are the ideals of the modern home? And so it was a really fantastic program that produced things from Pierre Koenig and Neutra and Eames, you know, many houses of which were built in the Los Angeles area, one of which is actually now for sale, the Stahl House, for like $25 million, which is another conversation we can have. But some really iconic architecture was born from that initiative, you know, trying to meet a need of a certain time. And we were approached by Crest Real Estate, who's a local land use consultant in Los Angeles, and they kind of work nationally now, who are friends of ours and who we have done a number of projects with. And they were actually the initiator of this project, the Case Study 2.0 project, which was meant to echo the initial case study program, but meet the needs of today. And today being specifically the fire rebuilding in Southern California from the Palisades and the Eaton fires. So they started this program, reaching out to all of the architecture contacts they had in Southern California, nationally and even internationally in some cases, to develop our own prototypes of what it could mean to help these neighborhoods rebuild, you know, specifically with an eye and an intention toward fire resiliency, you know, climate, understandings, environmental sensitivities, things like that.
And I think the thing that we haven't touched on yet at all is the idea that the original case study also was very attuned towards maybe bringing in what they were calling modern building materials or technologies and how they were going to use these forward-thinking technologies for mass production. And really, although it didn't get into prefab architecture, I think it started, you know, a conversation and was, if you really track back, one of the predecessors of what prefab architecture could be, and I guess will continue to unfold to be in the coming years.
Were there other firms that were invited, or are you the only one who's doing this case study program?
No, there's many firms. I think there's 40 to 50 firms. I think it's grown a little bit, but there's many firms that are taking part in the program. And there's, you know, a few different kind of responses to the fires that have popped up as far as initiatives like this, building initiatives, case study type programs. This one in particular, the goal was to create a catalog of homes that were thoughtfully designed with all of the things we've talked about already, you know, in mind and embedded into the designs and the planning of, and jumpstart the process for homeowners who were not thinking about having to rebuild in any way prior to this fire, giving them a head start in the process, right? Really effectively kind of putting them on second base in order to get going and get back into their homes and start rebuilding their homes, their lives, their community. There are a number of different approaches to the home building that we've seen from these, frankly, really fantastic and talented architecture firms that are taking part, things from modular homes, single story, two story homes, things oriented around courtyards, things with really interesting and innovative materials, modularity, customization, all kinds of things that are, you know, available for people to choose from this catalog, get connected directly to the architects, and then start that process with a design already been incubated and thought about. The other piece of this puzzle that Crest had kind of targeted was that not just that the architectural fees were standardized across all these firms, but also there was a target cost per square foot that we were designing towards. So this, you know, couldn't be made out of gold leaf. You know, it had to be something that could be easily buildable, you know, with standard materials, available materials, targeting a $500 to $800 a square foot construction cost roughly was what the goal was, so that we weren't designing things that were, you know, outlandishly expensive and could actually be built in these neighborhoods.
Which also, I know you have national listenership, so I think that if that may sound quite expensive to people in other, you know, areas, but for Southern California,
yeah,
$500 to $800 a square foot is quote unquote relatively affordable for building costs. So, you know, really understanding how to make something beautiful and functional, but also how to make it broadly accepted and also code compliant. And as Aaron said, getting homeowners a fast forward through the design process and into their homes faster.
I love the program. I love that it does give these homeowners who, you know, are devastated some hope and some guidance and some great design, but it also introduces them to the process of architecture, right? It gives them a process that sometimes is bypassed, right? Often clients will just go to a contractor and then, oh, you need an architect. Oh, I need an architect. So I'll go get an architect. But this actually, you know, introduces the process to these clients that architects design it and then the construction comes later.
And I think it also breaks it down in a great way because it is still a quote unquote custom home without being fully custom in that, you know, they don't, as we said, have to go through the full rigmarole, the design process, but they still get something specialized and more design savvy than maybe you would get from a builder, right? Or from some of these mass produced builders who are coming in to rebuild Palisades and Altadena, because frankly, there's so much housing stock that needs to be built. We need those builders as well, but this is kind of a good in between.
Yeah, for sure. So can you talk a little bit about your design for this project? Give us an overall idea of it, and then maybe walk through what makes it an appropriate prototype for this type of building.
Yeah. I think it was really interesting project to be a part of because, you know, we obviously are far removed from school, but when you're in school, you get the ability to have, you know, design charrettes as you're walking through projects and really get into the nitty-gritty of your high pie in the sky design ideas without client input. And sometimes you get to do that in residential design if you're doing like a spec development or something for a developer, but still, you know, they have input in the process. And this, there was no input from developers. There was no input from clients. It was really our own ideas and prescriptive thoughts that, you know, we were bringing to the table with hopefully open minds. The really big idea was that we had already been working in Palisades in particular, and we also work on the east side of Los Angeles in the Altadena area. Palisades for, I would say, 5 years at this point, where we're doing a lot of residential architecture at varying scales there. And so we really know the community and the end user. And I think that really helped in programming the home for us. And then the other thing that was really helpful was, unfortunately, our studio lost a client's home that we had just moved them into at the end of last year. It was very devastating. And so I ended up on one of the burn sites in Palisades about 3 weeks post-fire, and definitely one of the, you know, first people to go back up there and kind of see the devastation. And what remained incredibly apparent was that you have these urban infill lots where, you know, they're all very close together. They're all narrow. And especially in the hills where this was, you could see down the middle swipe of the lots, all the burn areas, right? Because that's where all the homes were located. But in the front and the back, the grass was still green as, you know, the day that the homes burned. And so it was very, very striking that, similar to, you know, you see these stories when there's a tornado and you see like a bottle of ketchup on a table near like a destructed house. You're like, how is that even possible in nature? But it really is, where you need to create in this space, defensible space, right? The idea that nature acts as a buffer for the architecture itself. And so because of that, I came to the table with this world experience seared into my memory, really thinking like, okay, on an urban infill lot, how do we create natural defensible space between structures? And so for us, along with the previous case study, the idea of a lot of indoor-outdoor experience, this is Southern California. You know, we have amazing weather 90% of the time. Let's really design this around very old world mentality of courtyard residential design, but also let's bring it into the modern realm where it's not just informing passive design, right? But it's also now informing defensible space against fire.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab, or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. When you look at the original case study program and the new case study program, obviously they had different objectives, right? One was trying to build affordable housing for people coming back from World War II and the boom that happened. And this is directly related to the fires and trying to design homes that not only get people back in their homes, but also protect them from future fires. Do you see any overlap and connection between the two programs in terms of housing and design?
Yeah, I think both of them are set to prove that design is not just a layer on top of something else. Design is part of the answer. Design, as famously quoted, is how it works. And a lot of what we're doing is about the design, not in, oh, what color is it? What shape is it? You know, the aesthetics of design, but design is how you move through the space, how it's organized, how it's, you know, like Harper said, how we organize the house around a courtyard in a meaningful and a thoughtful way to respond to some of these climate issues and these environmental issues. So both programs, we're putting design at the forefront, as I said, not in a way that is just a gloss layer on top of, you know, a house, but as something that is the first thing that you think of and kind of encapsulates all of the decision-making that you make around a project, right? So I think those are some really strong through lines between the two projects, in addition to kind of celebrating Southern California and Los Angeles and the design history that is embedded here, despite the rest of the country maybe not thinking it has such a strong design history. It really does.
Yeah, for sure. You can check out the work that AHA does at aha.studio. It's A-A-H-A. So A-A-H-A.studio is the website. You can go check out the work that they do and their case study 2.0 project. Has the program and the publicity that comes along with it impacted your business in any way?
I think that the program itself hasn't necessarily impacted the business. I think it was a great way for the Los Angeles architectural community and some of the architects outside of Los Angeles who are participating, a way for us to give back to the community and really rally around getting our hands in something and rolling up our sleeves and doing something productive. I think that the months directly post-fire were really heartbreaking. And, you know, we're a really hard time for the locals here. And it really allowed us to jump into helping in some way. I think for us, because we had been part of the Palisades community in terms of the work we were already doing, this was already something that we were very involved in from the moment the fire started. We were there with our clients, you know, talking them through, are they safe? You know, are they evacuating? What's going on with their homes? Some were lost, some were saved. You know, it was very emotionally fraught time. And so our studio was already heavily involved in discussing what to do with them and with all their direct neighbors and with a bunch of other people, just as a sounding board, right? Just as people who had been through this, unfortunately, very recently with the Woolsey fire in 2018, you know, we had experience with this. So this, the case study program was a way for us to get excited about helping versus just having those very emotional conversations with people and trying to walk them through, you know, the very long road ahead of them. This was a way to put pen to paper and really get something done quickly, which was a lifeline for all of us, really.
Yeah, focus some of that energy.
It's interesting how in crises like this or situations that are not typical, how the skills of being an architect rise to the top, right? That your non-design skills, the skills that we have as architects that are not design focused. You had mentioned how you were helping your clients through the process. A lot of that came from your skills of being able to know how to deal with people and solve problems and create processes. And those are all things that architects have innately in our education, in our talents and skills that are not design focused. Those are things that most people don't realize we have the skills to do. Did you experience that in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As I mentioned before, you know, having an interest in a lot of different things and having architecture be a vessel to explore so many different interests, it's also a profession that requires an enormous amount of interface with lots of different things, right? We need to know a little bit about insurance, about mortgages, about city processes, about government and public policy, you know, all of those things are so incredibly
therapy,
right? I think what Harper and I have always stressed is that the number one part of our business is customer service, right? Architecture is a vessel for customer service. You know, like that's what we need to do. We are serving a customer. We are not our own clients. You know, we are not developers that build our own buildings with our own money and all of that. Maybe one day. But right now, you know, the focus is on the client and the customer, and we have to serve their needs in more ways than anybody could possibly anticipate, right? I want to give so much credit to Harper in those first few weeks after the fire. She was on the phone constantly, right? Like she said, doing some therapy with clients, talking to them, making sure that their needs were met in ways that were not architectural or plan related or design decisions, you know, helping. We have such a unique perspective into what people need for so many of these things. And it was a way for us to feel, you know, in a selfish way, it gave us some purpose, right? It reminded us, as awful as it all was, us as the architectural and building and construction community writ large, it reminded us what our real skills are, right? And what our purpose can be and how we can help people, you know, truly. And that it's not just about making pretty pictures and posting renderings on Instagram, hoping you get a ton of likes. It's about helping people. It's about homeowners. It's about people living in their homes and their kids and what they need. And all of those things were just magnified to the thousandth degree following these fires.
And businesses for that matter too. You know, homeowners weren't the only people who were lost. I mean, a lot of people, especially in post-COVID work from home era, they lost their homes and their livelihoods because they had their businesses within their homes, or they had small businesses, you know, within the urban corridors of these small areas, you know, within Palisades, within Altadena. There was a lot of commercial space that was lost. And so really being able to help from various perspectives was really, really important. And in the end, architects are problem solvers. That's what we do. And I was so moved by all the people who stepped forward to help and try to problem solve so many different aspects of all the recovery components. And that showed through in, you know, with our local AIA chapter, we were very involved with them. We did a lot of roundtables with the city, the list goes on and on and on and on. You know, we created a Slack channel for the architectural community to help us figure out answers to the ever-evolving code requirements that we are going to be facing.
Yeah.
It's been a very momentous year, and I would love to see that momentum that we've created as an architectural community move forward. Hopefully, a lot of the case studies will be built. I think the first one is just breaking ground next year, not ours, but one in the program. And yeah, it's very exciting.
How is progress from the fires? Is it starting to build? Because I've heard, you know, you hear news reports. I was there in August and saw the devastation and didn't see a lot of progress. So how is the progress moving along?
It's starting to really move, which is very exciting. Next year, Q1, and I think into Q2 and Q3, there will be a lot of construction commencement going on. But we personally have started our first rebuild project in construction, and we have two more waiting to break ground within the next few weeks. There is a lot of building going on. I think there's even maybe one or two that are nearing completion, which is, I mean, crazy. Those were probably started from plans that already existed. They weren't new designs.
Yeah.
But if you look at the timetable, I mean, we started construction, I think, in October, end of October, on our first one, and the fire was in, you know, mid-January. So if you look at that timetable, that's pretty impressive.
Yes, very much so. It'll be exciting to watch those hills grow.
Yeah. I mean, you'll see them from every angle. We flew in, I don't know, a few weeks ago, we were coming back from an epic trip in Japan, and we flew over Palisades, and it's very different now than it was December of last year. And December of next year will be very different than it is today.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to watch it happen. Well, thank you for the work that you're doing there. It's people like you who are making it happen. And so thank you for that. As we wrap things up here, I want to ask you both my final question. I'm going to start with Harper. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think the biggest thing is really to keep learning and be curious. I think that we as architects get into the weeds very, very quickly. And although that is one way to learn, I think the part that will behoove your business more is that you learn a little bit about a lot of things. And in order to do that, you really have to take your head out of, you know, your book or your computer or whatever you're doing and really get involved in either the community or in, you know, your local chapters or workshops or, you know, whatever it is, and just really learn. And if you stay hungry to do that, then many things will come your way.
I agree. Aaron, what about you? What's one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Continue to say yes to things. You know, never say, well, that's not my job, to anybody, right? There's so many projects and kinds of things that you can learn from. I think every project is a learning opportunity, even if it may seem small or insignificant or frustrating. Even the bad ones, there's, you know, a lot to learn from. So continuing to say yes to interesting opportunities and know that everything that you do, whether it's, you know, helping a friend with a small project, that could turn into something later, you know, like, always be looking at the long game, not just, I don't want to do this. This is kind of annoying. Is there an interesting person you might meet while doing this project? Is it a jurisdiction you haven't worked in previously? Is it a project type that you've never done? If somebody is offering you the opportunity to do something, even if it may not be the most design forward project or opportunity, there's going to be some fruit that will bear from it. So keep your eyes open and don't close yourself off to opportunity, I guess I should say, in a less elegant way.
Their names are Harper Halperin and Aaron Lesh. The studio is AHA Studio. It's A-A-H-A Studio. And you can check out their work at aha.studio. And if you want to look at the case study program and want to learn more about the case study 2.0 program, it's casestudy2.com. So casestudy2.com, if you want to look at some of the other buildings and programs that are happening there. On Instagram, at aha_studio, if you want to follow them on Instagram. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've learned a lot about the work that you're doing and the progress that's happening in Southern California. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for dedicating yourself to that region and to those people, and representing our community of architects by doing that. And thank you for coming by here today and sharing your knowledge and your stories at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And If you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, two a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.